saying this. I think I mentioned something to this effect already earlier, that generational changes are like the tide. They always happen. Because generational differences, generations tend to be, on average, about 20 years long. About the time the next generation is coming along, those of us who are in any one given generation have already begun to forget what it is like to be the new and upcoming generation. We're now in the ascendancy. We're in the majority. We're the ones who are in places of position of control and authority and decision-making. And then the next generation comes along and sort of challenges that. We forget that we were just like them 20 years ago. And there's a tendency to be a little bit alarmist, to be a little bit reactionary, sometimes to be very reactionary, and to be very negative towards the up-and-coming generation. But like the tide, it is rarely hurtful. It may take us by surprise, but this has been happening since Adam and Eve. I do think, however, that the current millennial generation represents more than the average tidal change. I think it is almost like a tsunami. I think that happens occasionally, where there is such a major shift that it really does force us to stop and evaluate a lot of things, and that's where we are, in my estimation, in the church today. So having given that as a background, let's jump in and think about the fact that some things never change. So someone once said, for example, the children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority, they show disrespect for their elders, they love chatter in place of exercise. Children are now tyrants, not the servants of their households. They no longer raise or rise when elders enter the room. They contradict their parents, chatter before company, gobble up dainties at the table, cross their legs, tyrannize their teachers. Some of us want to say, yeah, that's right. And that was exactly the case when Socrates wrote this more than 2,000 years ago. And the point is, you know, these generational shifts have always been around. They're always with us. What if I told you, drawing from a popular movie analogy, what if I told you that this has been said about every generation ever? So whatever your fears, whatever your concerns about this generation, some of that is, well, it is what it is. It's always been there. It's not anything new. It's not anything radical. It's not anything that should surprise us. When we think about American generations represented in this church, no doubt, in society at large, we have some that are left still from the GI generation and what is sometimes referred to as the greatest generation. Most of those folks now are deceased. They're gone. There's only a handful left in any given location. That's followed by the silent generation, sometimes referred to as the builder generation, the people who stood on the shoulders of the GI generation and really, in many ways, built American society as we know it today. That's followed by the baby boomer generation, which up until that point in history was the, recent history, was the largest generation ever. That's why they were called the baby boomers. There was just this boom of amazing productivity, and birth rate went way out beyond anything that had been experienced before. By contrast, Generation X is the smallest generation in recent American history. Generation X, there are no doubt a number of Generation Xers here, and that is the smallest generation on the screen, at least. And then the millennials. The millennials, roughly, and let me say that some people will argue, first of all, that the dates are arbitrary. That's probably true. There's nobody who can sit around and say, okay, these are the exact dates for any given generational changes. Some people will even argue against labeling generations. I've had conversations with folks who just reject the whole idea of generational differences. And they'll say, look, in any given group of people, you have different characteristics. So there may be a millennial who is much more like the silent generation. There may be a baby boomer who is much more like the GI generation. That's always true. But there is a definable pattern, and sociologists are the ones who tend to give these distinctions or these discernible traits to a generation, often in retrospect. This is what this generation has come to be known for. And obviously, again, there's a lot of specifics that I could give, but I'm kind of moving through this quickly, as to what the definable characteristics of these generations are. We will talk about the millennials because that's the group in focus today. But there are definable characteristics for all of these generations. And if I took the time to give them to you, you would probably say, yeah, okay, that's true. I agree with that. I see that. That's been true in history. I want to point out as well, though, that this millennial generation is far and away the largest generation ever in American history. You see 77.9 million. Some people will argue as much as 80 million. It is not that baby boomers and Generation Xers have given birth to more babies than the silence in the GIs. If we counted only births in America, the baby boomer generation would remain the largest generation ever. But because of immigration, because of the mixture of immigration as well as productivity, healthy reproduction rates, we have now the millennials, which are the largest generation in American history. That's significant, and I think we need to take that into account as we move forward in our thinking. This generation that we're considering is most commonly known as millennials. There's some other names that have been thrown about. The only other one that is really stuck is Generation Y. So sometimes you'll hear millennials referred to as Generation Y. But millennials, because they come of age at the change of the millennium, that's the name that is most commonly stuck. There are a lot of caricatures about millennials. You've heard these, you've seen these, you may have thought these. These are some of the ideas that are often bandied about what millennials are like. Like any caricature, some of these traits are actually true. I have no problem standing in front of a group of millennials and say, you know what, by nature, some of you are really lazy. If we're honest, though, some baby boomers are really lazy, too. Are baby boomers by nature narcissistic? Are millennials by nature narcissistic? Yeah, probably. I'm not afraid to say that. There's a reason for that, though. And if we want another reason, we have to really look at ourselves and say, we've made them this way. We've developed this society in the fashion that we find it today. It was interesting to talk about millennials being sort of narcissistic. It's all about me. I want to be first. I want everything to fit my... Carrie and I were at a wedding yesterday, which was very fun because it was a wedding of a widower, probably, I would say, in his mid to late 60s, and a friend of ours that Carrie was a classmate with in college many, many years ago, who this is her first marriage. And so you have this marriage where the people standing in the wedding are old enough to be at least our age, and I think the people standing in the wedding, at least one of them was probably older than me. And I told my wife, I said, when you reach about 60 or so, you don't expect to be a bridesmaid anymore. But it so happened. And most of the guests were my age and older. And there were a few younger folks there, family and friends and so on. But most of the guests were, you know, older folks. And when they cut that cake, it was like pandemonium. And I just stood there and I was amazed because, you know, you think of baby boomers and older, you know, we're orderly, we're socially conditioned, and we're all going to get in line. And it was like everybody came at this table from different directions, and everybody was literally pushing and edging to get to the cake first. And I looked at that and I thought, these are people that are narcissistic. You know, it's all about me. I got to get my cake before anybody else. And I just kind of laughed to myself and I thought, this isn't a generational thing. This is a human thing, you know. This is part of being a human being. The image of the millennial as being sort of content with himself or herself is probably true. It is a generation which has been socially conditioned to believe that their sense of self-worth and self-importance is able to do anything, able to reach any heights. I have a T-shirt which I bought to work in the yard and do stuff around the house because it was cheap. It was like a dollar at Walmart. But I bought the T-shirt and it says, they told me I could be anything, so I became awesome. So I wore that to the gym one day. That was a big mistake. It's like, you're not awesome. So I don't wear that to the gym anymore. But that, you know, there's this mentality, and we've told the kids this for the last 20 years or more. You can be anything. You can do anything. You can. And there's some value in that message. There's some hope in that message. There's some good in that message, but the idea that I'm okay, or you're okay, I'm perfect. When I was in school, the big thing, I went to school in high school in the 70s, the big thing was, I'm okay, you're okay. Remember that? And it was almost a campaign. I mean, it's everywhere, I'm okay, you're okay. It's all just accept each other. Well, there really is a sense in which you're okay, but I'm perfect is sort of the mantra today. There's also this image of the millennial child growing up with not only technology at their fingertips, but with a sense of being vastly overprotected. I was talking to somebody just a few minutes ago about when we were kids, we'd, you know, go anywhere, do anything. I can remember as a child growing up in central Illinois in the 70s, I'd get on my bicycle at sunup or shortly after, And my mother wouldn't even say, what are you doing today? She'd just say, have a good day. And off I would go. And I would go all over the county on my bicycle. And we got into all kinds of stuff that today I'd be mortified if my kids were doing. And never really gotten any serious trouble. You know, a few times got in trouble here and there, but nothing really all that serious. And at sunlight or sundown, we'd come back. And, you know, that was normal. That was acceptable. But you can't really do that today. We've either society has gotten worse or we've become more aware of the dangers. Perhaps that's the case because of media and we're aware of a lot of dangers out there. We become typically rather overprotective of our kids. That's understandable. So this is the society in which these kids have been raised. This is part of what has made them to be what they are. Some people take a very, very positive approach to this generation. Here's an example. This is written by two sociologists who perhaps are even a bit too optimistic. This was written kind of early, in 1987, I think, if I remember correctly. And they wrote, as a group, millennials are unlike any other youth generation in living memory. They are more numerous, more affluent, better educated, and more ethnically diverse. All of that is incontrovertibly true. More important, they're beginning to manifest a wide variety of positive social habits that older Americans no longer associate with youth, including a new focus on teamwork, achievement, modesty, and good conduct. Only a few years from now, this can-do youth revolution will overwhelm the cynics and pessimists. Over the next decade, the millennial generation will entirely recast the image of youth from downbeat and alienated to upbeat and engaged, with potentially seismic consequences for America. Well, that sounds really almost utopian, almost too good to be true, and perhaps it is. As I said, this was written probably before we had a really, really good grasp of the output of the millennial generation. But here's something that kind of goes the other direction, written by a guy named Tim Elmore in a book called Generation IY, Our Last Chance to Save Their Future. Have any of you read anything by Tim Elmore? I talked to several people who get a little bit upset when I criticize Tim Elmore because they write him and think, well, this is the greatest thing ever. And all I would say to that is, read Tim Elmore. He's good. He's good at what he does. But don't read only Tim Elmore. Get some perspective. Get something a little bit broader than that. Elmore is a guy who works as a consultant he's a business consultant, helping businesses learn how to integrate millennials. And most of the stuff that's being written out there is in that sort of genre. It's business coaches trying to help businesses figure out, okay, what do we do with these younger people? Because there's a lot of them, they're on the ascendancy, they're taking over little by little. How do we keep our business and save what we've invested and created, and at the same time, you know, integrate well with millennials? So there's a lot of that kind of thinking going on. And a great variety of books have been written. Elmore kind of takes a little bit negative approach. He's one of those people who says we really need to fix the next generation. That comes out in what he says here. Ready or not, they are now entering the adult world. And unless we wake up and make some adjustments in the way we interact with them, I predict rough waters ahead. We can already see several unintended consequences of this new world we've created for them. A world that allows for high speed, constant connection, sedentary lifestyles, pitiful relational skills, and a large dose of narcissism. Again, much of what he says is true, but his outlook is rather gloomy, rather negative. He really does believe that this is our last chance to save not only the generation, but America, what he writes. Here's a biblical perspective. I won't read through this because I read it in the message this morning. But the point that I would make with this is very simply this. You're always going to have people who are different from you, whether it's because of different generations or because of different societies, different cultures, different backgrounds, different countries, different ethnicities. We are always going to find people who are not like us. Again, I think God takes delight in that. That doesn't mean that God delights in those aspects of any culture or society that are contrary to himself or that are sinful. But those aspects that can be redeemed and made to serve God in his glory are wonderful and beautiful. I think of, we even referenced this morning in one of the songs, but the passage in Revelation chapter 5, where you have before the throne of the Lamb people of every tribe, tongue, and nation. And I think to myself, how did John know that these were from every tribe, tongue, and nation? See, I think some of us have the idea that when we get to heaven, we're all going to be homogenized. We're all going to look like middle-class white Americans. We're all going to sing like middle-class white Americans. We're all going to talk and think like middle-class white Americans. How did John know that you had people from every tribe, tongue, and nation? I think they were still ethnically diverse in heaven. I think they were still talking with different accents, maybe different languages. They were still probably when they went to the marriage feast of the Lamb, some of those people were eating cicadas. You know, some of them were eating sheep intestines, and some of them were eating hot dogs. And I think that diversity will continue in some way throughout eternity, because I think God likes that. He enjoys that. And so when we think about people who are different than we are, whether it's because they're from Africa or China or, you know, South America, or because they are of a different generation than me, we should not look at them and say, how do I fix them? How do I correct them? How do I make them more like me? We should look at them and say, how do we together become more like Christ? How can I work with these people for their benefit, for the kingdom of God? I think that's the biblical perspective. So having said that, let me point out some of the reason why, at least as I understand it, why millennials are different than previous generations. The two main factors are what you see on the screen. First is higher education. When I graduated from high school in 1979, that was considered a pretty good thing. A lot of people in my parents' generation didn't graduate from high school, frankly. Graduating from high school was enough to get you a pretty good job. A lot of folks that I went to high school with, that was it. They finished high school, that was it. They took jobs and they're productive. I have a cousin I went to high school with who makes a whole lot more money than I do. He runs a furniture business. Never went to college a day in his life. He's very successful, very happy, good guy. That was considered normal. But by that period of history, 1979, 1980, around that time, going to college was considered a good thing if you could do it. So probably about 40%, 30 to 40% of American students went to college. And if you wanted a really good job, if you wanted to be really successful, you had a college education. Today, to be really successful, to be really on the higher end of the earning scale, you really need a graduate education. So education has continued to push the limits. And along with that, education has become very egalitarian. Whereas it was thought everybody should have a high school education. Everybody should have a chance to finish high school. Now the idea is everybody should have a chance to finish college. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, passing laws that will pay for all of college education. We're moving sort of in that direction. Because that's the expectation. Every American should have a chance to at least have a college education. And then beyond that, to go into graduate studies. When I graduated from Bowdoin University in 1983, there was a call, you know, if you really want to go further, here's an opportunity to go and do some graduate education, get a seminary degree or whatever, get some more graduate education, whatever your field. And there was probably 20% or so of people that did that. Now, it's almost a given now. When I talk to freshmen, when I talk to people just starting out in their education, they'll talk in terms of their future, and they'll talk about graduate education as a given. Doesn't mean everybody does it, excuse me, but I think that's the norm more than the exception today. So higher education has become part of who we are. That contributes to this idea we call adult adolescence. There's a number of terms out there, the boomerang generation, they come back home. There's a number of things that aren't so flattering, perhaps. But the idea of adult adolescence is that we have extended the time frame for becoming an adult. What are the markers of adulthood? Getting married, having a job, establishing a career, having children, owning your own home. And those things are being gradually postponed further and further. So where it's not happening at 20 or even at 25, sometimes now those things are happening closer to 30 or beyond. And part of that is higher education. Part of that is also this idea of the prolonged identity quest. Because students or young people have the opportunity now to decide who they are going to be, what is their identity in life, they don't have to decide that by the time they finish high school. They don't have to decide that by the time they finish college. They don't have to even decide that in some cases by the time they finish graduate school. They will postpone that. So there's this prolonged identity quest. There is this thing in sociology in which you have this sort of endless cycle of self-definition. So you have some circumstance of your education, circumstance of your upbringing, circumstance of, you know, a death in the family or your basic intelligence or whatever it is that makes you who you are. And that circumstance then begins to shape and form your identity. We've all experienced this, right? And then you have a changed circumstance. And that kind of forces you to rethink. Okay, now who am I? Now what do I believe? What do I think? And that leads to this sort of crisis and searching. And this cycle goes on. Here's the difference, folks. If you're my age, you probably experienced this cycle in junior high. Remember junior high? Remember, like, you just didn't know who you were? And every day, I remember I was in the eighth grade. I got beat up by a girl. I think that's the first time I've ever admitted that publicly. Now, if I remember right, she was like 8 feet tall. She was hairy and brutal, you know. But she beat me up pretty well. And I probably deserved it. I don't remember exactly what I was doing. But I'm sure I antagonized it. And I was taught you don't ever hit a girl. So I didn't. But she hit me. Boy, she decked me. And you know, when you have that happen to you in junior high, you have to get back and think, what is that about? You know, who am I and what's going on? And those kinds of experiences, they shape you, they mold you, they make you into the person you become. But that sort of cycle of self-identification now doesn't happen in high school or in junior high or in high school. Sometimes it doesn't even happen in college. I see this on the campus of Bob Jones University all the time. You see a guy, he comes to class, and he's got a coat and tie on. It's like, you don't have to wear a coat and tie at Bob Jones anymore, you know. Not just to class, but this guy will come in, he's all decked out. He's all pimped up, you know, he looks really good. And the next day he'll come in, or a week later he'll come in, and he'll be as close to looking like a bum as can possibly be managed and still be a student at Bob Jones. And next week he'll come in with some kind of a hat that's like, you know, what I'm saying is, what's happening? They're trying to figure out who they are. Where do they fit in? What do I want to be? Or they'll change their major, not just once, twice, three, four, five, eight times. Part of that is this normal cycle of trying to determine who I am. What I'm saying to you is this is getting postponed further and further to being older and older. And that explains part of what's happening with our interaction with millennials. They're trying to figure out who they are. Where we're accustomed to, when we went there, and the people that came immediately after us, we're accustomed to seeing them having figured that out a long time ago. I have some friends, professors at Bob Jones, who say, we need to coach freshmen so that they know exactly what they're going to do, so that we can give them all the right training so that they can be in the right classes and be prepared for their career. And I just want to laugh, and I'm thinking, no freshman knows that. I mean, there may be a few. There may be, you know, 3% of the overall population. But very, very rarely does that happen. Most of the time, they're in this cycle. Doesn't mean they don't choose a major, but don't be shocked when they come along and change it later on. Okay. There is among millennials a strong sense of entitlement. I deserve this. I'm owed this. And a sense of egalitarianism. Does it bother you, those of you who are my age, when some millennial calls you by your first name? Hey, Mark, how you doing? Thinking, you know, you could almost be my grandchild. That does bother me a little bit. And I admit that. And part of the reason it bothers me is because I'm a product of my generation. But there is this sense of, look, we're all in this together. Now, Americans, we believe that. We believe in egalitarianism. We believe everyone's equal. We all have the same rights. We all have the same freedom. We believe that on paper. We believe that conceptually. But we haven't really experienced that. We don't really live that. We're learning to experience that more and more, perhaps. But the millennials, they've been taught this. They've been conditioned to think this way by media, by public education, by various factors, since the day they were born. So they really do see everyone as exactly equal. Okay. And whether you choose to be offended by that is up to you, but that is part of the way they think. It's very egalitarian. Everybody's equal. Everybody's the same. In the sense of entitlement, that I really am owed something. And that comes, as you see on the screen, from things like overprotective parents, marketing aimed at kids. You know, it used to be that The only marketing I can remember aimed at kids when I was a kid growing up was, you know, breakfast cereal and toys. But now, sometimes you get the impression that you should buy this car because your kids like it, right? I mean, it's all focused on marketing to every person in the family, and children are studied for how do we sell things to children? How do we market things to children? And you can think of examples of that. There's general societal affluence. Some of you are out of work, so you don't feel very affluent. But you know very well that compared to the time when you and I were growing up, some of you might, as a general rule, society is much more affluent than it was back then, as a general rule. Then you have this fantasy world created by media, whether it be movies and television shows or gaming and so forth. There's this ability to sort of enter into another world in fantasy and become something that you're not. That, I think, also adds to this whole sense of identity quest. You can have an avatar and be somebody online and be somebody completely different in class or in your day-to-day social life. So this fantasy world contributes to this. And then you just have these unbelievable myriad of options. So many options. Carrie's brother, Carrie was born in Cuba, came to the U.S. when she was a child, but her older brother did not come to the U.S. until 25 years later, because I won't go into that story, but it wasn't by his choice. It just kind of happened that way. And when her older brother finally came, he was at that time about 40, something like that. And I remember taking him to Home Depot. This was in Tampa, Florida. Taking him to Home Depot. You take a guy who's lived in communist Cuba for his whole adult life, which is the epitome of scarcity. Take him into Home Depot. We walked in the front door, and he just stood there and he looked around, and he was just like, and he said, "Is this like the resource store for the entire United States of America?" And I said, "No, there are four of these stores here in Tampa just like this." He literally started shaking. He turned and walked out. He said, "I can't do this. I can't handle this. I can't imagine so many choices." Right? Well, we've all grown up not just with Home Depot, but with Amazon.com, and with Google. I mean, those who are younger than me, you've grown up with that. That's all you've ever known. You can't imagine a world where your first impulse is not to Google something, where your first impulse is not to see what are all the choices. I talked to a guy, a millennial, about 30 years old, not long ago, a very smart guy, has a PhD from Bob Jones, incredibly gifted, has a brain that I wish I had, and we were talking. He said, "You know, I'm really stressed out." And I said, "Well, what are you stressed out about? Why are you stressed out? You've got one child, you've got, you know, your wife, and you seem to have a good relationship. You're active in your church, but you're not over, and you're not involved to the point of, you know, being drained. And I know what you do. Your job, it's not that overly stressful. So why are you so stressed out?" I mean, he was almost neurotic. He said, "I just can't keep up. I can't keep up with everything. I just can't do it all." I said, "Well, what all are you trying to do?" He said, "It's the blogs. I can't keep up with the blogs. You know how many blogs there are? I try to read them all. I try to comment on them all. I try to write them all. But I can't. I can't. I can't do it." And he was almost hysterical. And I said, "What?" I said, he says, "Well, how many blogs do you do?" I said, "None. I mean, occasionally I'll look, but I'll look and I say, well, that's nice. And then a few months later, I'll look again. Well, that's nice. But I mean, it's not like part of my life." But this guy, he had hundreds of blogs he was trying to keep up with every day. And he was stressed out. And I thought, okay. But in his mind, he's got to keep up with all the options out there. He's got to keep everything going. And this sense of, "I've got to keep all my options open all the time," is very much a defining characteristic of the millennial generation. Okay. Now, let's switch gears a little bit and think what motivates millennials. And I'm thinking here not just about millennials in general, millennials in society, but millennials in your church, millennials in Christianity. What motivates millennials? The first thing I would say is authenticity over antiquity. There was a time in history where you could motivate people like me, by talking about the history of an institution. "This institution has been around for 200 years. This institution has withstood the test of time." You know what? That doesn't mean anything to a millennial. Because you think about it, for most of us, history began the day I was born. Right? That's when the world began. And millennials are just not impressed with antiquity for antiquity's sake. What they want to see is authenticity. Now, if you can blend those together, yes, we're 200 years old, but we also are continuing to carry out the mission, and we're doing this in an authentic way that pleases the Lord and makes a difference. We're having an impact on the world. That means something. And when I've given this presentation to mission agencies, I said, "Look, don't tell the millennial how old your mission agency is, how long you've been around. Tell them what you're doing now. Impress them with what activity you are accomplishing that is authentically demonstrating Christ in the world in which we actually live." That makes a difference. So authenticity. Credibility over creed. Creeds are wonderful. Creeds are very helpful in defining what we believe and why we believe it. So I'm not saying throw out the creed. I'm saying you've got to go beyond the creed. You've got to show them credibility. Okay, so I stand, I believe this and I believe that, and I hold to this and I hold to that. But then I go out and I live like the devil. I go home and I treat my wife poorly. I go home and I ignore my kids. I cheat the mechanic. I brag about how I, you know, added a little bit on my income taxes to save myself. When I do things like that, all my credibility is gone. And so I can say, "But I have the right creed." Doesn't mean anything to millennials. They could care less. What they want to know is, are you credible in your practice of Christianity? And then orthopraxy, that is the practice, the application of right truth or right doctrine over just orthodoxy. we rightly, and I'm not, you heard what I said this morning about holding fast to correct doctrine. Let's not ever move away from that. But let's not say that's enough. Let's not just tell our young people it's enough to believe what we believe. There is a great fallacy in American Christianity in general. I'm not saying fundamentalism or this church. I'm saying in general in American Christianity. And that is a fallacy that we replace what we know with what we do. Or we replace doing with just knowing. And we come to believe, and part of this is, we're in an educational environment here, especially in the shadow of some really great educational institutions. And we tend to deceive ourselves into believing that knowing certain things makes us spiritually mature. Knowing things doesn't make you anything more than a guy who has knowledge. And it is not just a proper understanding that is impressive or valuable. It is a proper practice. It is, what does that look like? Don't tell me about how you, don't talk to me about the proper understanding of compassion for lost people. Let me see you go out and talk to someone who's lost. Let me see you give of your resources to help someone who is poor. Let me see what it's like to truly follow Christ. So orthopraxy over orthodoxy. Experience over expertise. Well, I've studied and I know. Good. Amen. But don't make that a replacement for I'm doing this. And as you can see, a lot of these overlap to some extent. But experience. I've actually done this. I've been there. I find that millennials will gravitate to somebody who can show them they've been there and done that. They have experience. They know what this looks like. They've been through the battle, for example, and they've survived, and they can now give you something to share from their experience. Passion over position. We hold the right truth. We hold the right doctrine. Our position is, in 10 different directions, it is right. It is well-founded. Okay, good. But where's the passion with that? Where's the enthusiasm? I didn't do it here because it's not my church and I don't want to offend people, but I'm an arm raiser. I am. Unashamedly. You know why? Because I get excited. You sing some of these songs, and I may be doing this, but inside I am jumping up in there. I am so excited. This is wonderful. This is great stuff. Okay. I'm not saying you need to raise your arm. That's immaterial to me. But here's my point is, okay, let's not substitute just I have the right position, but don't you dare show any enthusiasm for this. That's why I emphasized this morning experience. Experience is a wonderfully good thing. Okay? We're supposed to experience this. We are people created with a soul, with emotion, with joy, with a sense of delight and passion for what is true. Not just I hold the truth, but I'm passionate about it. I'm willing to sacrifice. I'm willing to be whatever it takes to follow Christ. And this generation, they get that. And they're looking for that. They are hungry for that. And then one other, discipleship over discipline. Being highly disciplined does not make you a great Christian. My son is a Marine. My son is extremely disciplined. My son is, he is as physically fit, I think, as a person is possible to be physically fit right now. And there are days when I don't feel like going to the gym, and I think, if I were a Marine, I'd have to go. And I think of my son, I think, that's a motivation for me. I get up and I say, if my son can do it, I can do it. Maybe not as well, but I'll try. But what I'm saying is, being a good disciplined Marine doesn't make you a good Christian, right? And sometimes we have given the impression that if I'm a highly disciplined person, that makes God happy. It doesn't really impress God, I don't think, all that much at all, quite frankly, not in and of itself. Because anybody can be disciplined. You can discipline your dog to do the right things. That doesn't impress God. But discipleship is exactly what God has given us, what Christ has given us to do. That was his instruction to his followers, go into the world and make disciples. Reproduce. Now, those two are not distinct any more than any of these things are distinct. They overlap. They go together. You must have some sense of discipline to have discipleship. Yes, but you can't have one without you could have just discipline without discipleship. But what young people are looking for is someone who will help them to grow to become Christ-like. Don't just tell me the right things to do. Don't just tell me the right rules to follow. Show me, help me, coach me, grow me, disciple me, make me into a follower of Jesus Christ. And that's a good thing. We should all be excited about that. So that's what motivates millennials. One other here, relationships over reputations. Don't just tell people where they're wrong. Reputations sometimes are necessary. I mean, Paul rebuked Peter, as we saw this morning. Peter and Paul and Barnabas, they stridently argued with the Judaizers and said, you're wrong. So reputations are good when they're necessary. But at the end of the day, what you really want are relationships. And sometimes you have to have the reputation before the relationship. But don't feel like you've won the day because you won the argument. You have not really won until you've gained a brother, until you have someone who you are with whom you are building a relationship. You can kind of look at this image, and I think if you've been around this many years, you can certainly relate to this. In the authoritarian era of the 50s and before, it was question nothing. I sometimes use the illustration of saying, if you told somebody who was from the GI generation or the Builder generation jump, they would just jump. If you had the authority to tell them, they would just jump. Question nothing. If you told me, I mean, I'm a product of the 70s, if you say, jump, I'm going to say, why? And that's the first thing that would come to my mind. Naturally, automatically, why? Give me a good reason and I'll jump. But you got to give me a good reason. The 1990s is the rise, although it had been here in some ways before this, but it became really prominent. That's the time of postmodernism. And now it's, you know, define jumping. What is the point of jumping? When you say jump, do you mean the same thing as what this person means is jumping? So everything gets bogged down into, well, what is your meta-narrative of jumping? There is no, you know, it's all this kind of stuff that you don't even know what's happening. So questions. But I really think that most of the millennials that I know, at least, they're at a point where they're like, okay, enough questions. Let's just do something. Let's just stop analyzing and let's do something. Let's get busy. Let's find a cause. Let's find a purpose. And let's serve Christ. Let's get on with it. And so I think that's where we are with most of this generation. There's enough questions, enough discussion. Let's get out and let's get busy. Now, again, part of my whole thinking with this is that there are certain aspects of millennial thinking that are actually advantageous. So let me share some of these with you. First of all, millennials are highly relational. Some people will refute that. Remember Tim Elmore said they're relationally challenged. I don't think so. The way millennials form relationships may not look the same as the way I form relationships. They may do it digitally. They may be on Facebook and Twitter, but that is still a relationship. And they tend to be fiercely loyal on some level to those relationships. I've never watched the show, but I know that it is indicative of this kind of thinking, that show that was on a few years ago called Friends, where you just have a group of people that they just know each other, hang out together, they live their life together. I see that all the time, where people become sort of tribes. They separate in their tribe, and that tribe becomes their life. My children are like that, no question about it. And I suspect that your children are as well, those of you who have millennial children. And so highly relational. That can be a big advantage because relationships are the substance of discipleship. You can teach people, but you cannot disciple people outside of relationships. There's a big difference between standing in front of a class and teaching people and getting down and getting with people and really relating to them and coaching them and helping them grow, which is what discipleship amounts to. So being highly relational is very positive. It should fill us with a great amount of enthusiasm. They're hopeful and optimistic, sometimes naively so, but what youth generation is not somewhat naive. So hopeful and optimistic, the idea that I can make a difference, I can change things. Do you really want a group of people who have the opposite view? Sometimes that becomes a challenge in church. You know, let's do something, let's move forward, let's try this. No, we don't do that, we don't try that. And so sometimes that optimism can be a little bit annoying, it can be a little bit challenging. But again, would you really have the opposite? I think we need to tap into and take advantage of that hopefulness, that optimism. And when they are together, because millennials have learned to work in unity and to work as a network, to solve life's problems and to approach life's challenges as a group rather than as individuals, I think that hopefulness and that optimism is very, very much an advantage that we can use for the benefit of the congregation. They're culturally pluralistic. Pluralism is often thought of as almost a negative thing, a bad word. It can be. If pluralism means you embrace everything as equally true. But cultural pluralism is just the idea that, look, there are different people, they think differently, and that's okay. It's okay that people are different. They don't all have to be exactly like me. I mean, I grew up in a time where we used all kinds of racial slurs. I grew up in a place where it was mostly Italian, and you had the Italian people in this city and the Polish people in the other city. And I know all the names that Italians call Poles, and all the, I almost used one of them, and all the names that the Poles use for the Italians, and none of them are really very pleasant. And that was just kind of normal, right? That was the world I grew up in. That was normal. But you don't do that anymore. You can't get away with that. But the worst thing you can do now is use a racial or ethnic slur. I think that cultural pluralism has actually given our young people an advantage. Because, I'll give you an example in the arena of missions. I remember having a discussion with a group of senior mission students. This would be around 2002 or so. And talking about black culture, African-American culture. And one of the students really wanted to argue with me. Say, you know what, there is no such thing as black culture. That's just an excuse for bad behavior. I said, really? And he just was vehement that, you know, this whole idea of different cultural, different social and cultural influences was just a myth. I never have those conversations anymore. I never meet anybody who's a millennial age person who even thinks in those terms. And I frankly think that's good because that prepares them to have a broader outreach and a more open attitude towards people who are different than them. I see that as being a hopeful thing. And then they're globally oriented. They've got a good sense of the big picture, and that's almost entirely because of Google, frankly. They see the world as being very close by. They trend towards entrepreneurialism, which means they find ways to fix things. Good. Let them. They may not fix it the way you want to. They may not come up with the same solution you would have, but that's a really good thing. I could give you lots of examples of people in business that I've talked to that are like, you know, these millennials come in here and they basically want to take over the company. I say, well, what do you mean? Well, they want to know how everything works. I tell them, you only have to know this piece and how they fit together. But they want to know how all the pieces fit together. And I said, just think about what would happen if you actually told them. This person may be the greatest asset you've ever had. This person may be able to network with other people even outside your company and come up with solutions you haven't even thought of yet and identify problems that you don't even know exist. So let them be entrepreneurial. And in church, that might be challenging. It's challenging the status quo. But again, there's a lot of energy and opportunity there. And I say, you know, let's let them try. Let's give them opportunities to see what they can do. And as I've already mentioned, they have the advantage of being the largest generation in American history. You cannot ignore them. You cannot say, look, let's just either I'm going to fix them or I'm going to ignore them. We'll have church for the older generations, and because they'll leave. They'll go out and they'll do some, they're entrepreneurs. They'll start their own church. They'll do something different. Will church look the same as it does today in 20 years? Of course not. You know why? Because people aren't the same. You know, the way we do church today is similar to the way we did it 20 years ago, but it's not exactly the same. Because we go through change, we go through generational shifts. And to the extent that it is not a violation of Scripture, that's okay, that's a good thing. Just like you could go to, you know, South America and church would be different there than it is here. That's okay, because culture and society changes all around us. Well, let me quickly give you some prescriptive ideas for engaging millennials. First of all, make worship a meaningful experience. Now, what that means for you in this church may look different than what it means for us at Heritage. But I really think that worship should engage a person's mind and spirit. Worship is not, okay, look, I'm bringing this package together. I've really worked on this, Lord. I put this all together just right, and I'm bringing it to you. Here, I hope this makes you happy. That's not really worship. I think worship is I'm casting myself before you and I'm enjoying you, Lord. I'm enjoying you and your people. I really like this. I really want to stay here and enjoy you longer. And in my enjoyment, I am putting myself completely at your disposal. I want to be everything you want me to be. I think that's where real worship takes place. And to the extent that we can help our younger audience to have that sense of entering into joyful relationship with God. And again, I'm not defining what that looks like. I'm not saying that only a certain kind of music does that, and a certain kind of music doesn't. That's not my point at all. I don't really think that's the case. I don't think you can say if you had, you know, drums and a guitar, that would be meaningful worship. I really don't think that's the case, because when I've been to churches like that, what I see is everybody stands around and watches as if it's a show. That's not meaningful experience. It's a show. What I'm saying is you've got to find ways to get people engaged in that experience of worship, whatever that means and how that works for you. Develop intergenerational activities. Brother Arrowwood was telling me about activity that you had, was it last week? Getting your college-age young people and your senior citizens, or maybe they're not senior citizens, but your older generation, getting them together and having a group activity. I think that's exactly the case. We've been having this men's Bible study at Heritage, and we had sort of a men's breakfast yesterday and testimonies about what we've learned from the men's Bible study. And what was really, really encouraging to me was several people my age and older got up and said, I've really connected with some younger people, and I've really, I mean, they're challenging to me. And when they open up and they share their life, it's like, this is exciting, this is encouraging. That's exactly the point. Look, this generation does not look at the older generation as, oh, you're the enemy. They really don't. Maybe sometimes it feels that way, but they really don't. They really want the interaction with you. And if you can take the time to get to know them and listen to them, that's my next point, listen to them and their ideas, that can have marvelous implications for the sense of growing together. Don't begrudge their technology. See, here's what happens. If I have an iPad, that's like a really cool device. That's almost like a really nice toy. But for a millennial, the latest phone, the latest iPad, whatever, the latest device is not a toy. That's a tool. It's like if I went to work tomorrow and they said, look, we need you to make 5 copies of this. Here's some carbon paper. I'd say, what? What? I haven't seen carbon paper since the 70s. That's how it feels to a millennial when you say, you know what? Your device is just a toy for you to play with. That's how it feels. No, it's a tool. They're actually quite productive. They know how to use them, in most cases, better than we do. So don't begrudge their technology. Technology is one of those other factors that has really changed the world and changed this generation, but that's a whole other discussion. And then coach them in adult responsibility. Don't just tell them where they're different, therefore where they're wrong. Don't just tell them, you know, when I was your age, I had a job, I had a wife, I had a car, I had a house. Don't do that. Don't do that. If you see someone, you say, you know what, you're not quite measuring up to adulthood, help them, coach them. When you get into business literature about millennials, the number one term that comes up over and over again is coach or coaching. Millennials don't want somebody to manage them. They don't want somebody to supervise them. They want somebody to coach them, to get down on their level and help them, grow them. You know what? That is the nature of the church. That is the whole nature of the body of Christ. We come alongside each other and we coach one another to grow into Christ-likeness. What a beautiful opportunity to coach the next generation. And then distinguish between cultural traditions and biblical absolutes. You know what? If I was living in the first century, it would be so easy to be with those Judaizers and to say, you know, this is the way it has to be, because that's all they ever knew. Those people who grew up in Jewish society, how could they help but say, it's got to be this way and no other way? It took somebody visionary, somebody who really was led by God, such as the Apostle Paul and James and others, to say, you know what? That's not, just because it's always been this way, doesn't mean it has to stay that way. There's something better than just our history and our tradition. That's really, really hard to do, because we have all been conditioned by our history and our tradition, all of us. But we have to be careful that we can distinguish between what is essentially biblical and what is simply tradition. It doesn't mean tradition is bad, you know. Is it bad if you get up and you recite the Our Father in your service? No. But if you sing the doxology, wonderful. Just don't make that into being a cornerstone of, you know, if you don't do this, you're not an Orthodox Christian. So tradition is not a bad thing. I'm not denouncing tradition at all. I'm just saying, make sure you help people understand what's tradition and what's not. And to the extent that you can do that, you can ask people to joyfully engage in the tradition. This is who we are. This is what we do. And together, we grow up in Christ-likeness. Okay. I didn't leave any time for questions. Should...